Thanks for tuning in to the Glossy Beauty Podcast. I'm your host, Priya Rao, Executive Editor at Glossy. And today, our podcast is turning one. If you've been listening for a while, you know that we speak with the people truly making change happen in the beauty and wellness industries. To that end, we've rounded up three clips from the most popular interviews of the last year, which we think you will enjoy. First up is Vicky Tsai, the founder of Tatcha, which was recently acquired by Unilever. As you'll hear, I wanted to know more about how Vicky brought an overlooked Japanese beauty product to the U.S. more than a decade ago. What about bringing something that's so heritage and so traditional to a modern customer? How does that kind of work for you?
That's a great question. When we first started 10 years ago, everybody was like, yeah, don't do it. That's not going to work. They said, if you look at other Japanese skincare brands that have tried to really break through in the U.S., they've had middling success at best. And the feedback that I had gotten was people want technology. They want the newest peptide. They want things that they can only get in the doctor's office. Tradition and natural and certainly an Eastern approach to beauty was not at all cool when we started. But it was real, and it was what healed me. And not only that, but the culture in Japan, which has so much humanity and beauty and authenticity and integrity, and it all comes through in their products, that I was like, well, okay, maybe it'll never be big, but I need it. And I feel like there is a man or a woman out there who is looking for authenticity and simplicity in their lives too. And so maybe they'll appreciate it and maybe I'll find like-minded people. And we just sort of went off from there.
Vicky, you started with blotting papers, which is a very, a singular but hero product for Tatcha. How did you kind of wrap people's mind around that and build an assortment from there?
It's also a great question. Everybody was like, don't do it. Nobody knows what blotting papers are here. So the reason that we brought the blotting papers here first was because, one, they're authentically what led me to Japan. Because of my acute dermatitis, I could only use Aquaphor on my face, and I was super greasy as a result. But it does work very well for those of us who have very chapped and delicate skin. And so when I was there, I was looking for the blotting papers, and then it was the blotting paper gold leaf makers. It's actually the byproduct of the gold leaf hammering process. When you hammer gold, is you need hammering paper. So it's actually gold hammering paper. They're the ones who introduced me to the first geisha. And I thought it was incredible that the first of anything was still around, especially something that it was still handmade. It's still the gold standard, literally. And then it has such a beautiful and true rich history. And so I was like, I have to bring these to the world. And I remember I asked the artisans, can I buy these blotting papers and bring them to the U.S.? And they said, no. And I was like, okay, let me rephrase that question. How many would I have to buy to bring these to the U.S.? And they said 10,000. And I think I was feeling cavalier, and I was like, I'll do it. And then I called my husband that night, and I was like, I have just bought 10,000 blotting papers. And he said, how are you going to pay for that? And I was like, oh, I didn't think of that. And then I looked down and I was like, I'll just sell my engagement ring. So congratulations, Priya, by the way, on getting engaged. So that's where it started. And then when we first brought it to the U.S., I tried to hire PR agencies. And, you know, they said, you don't have a story here. Nobody cares about Japanese beauty or natural or blotting papers. And I was like, understood. Okay. So I started just sending them to editors and makeup artists. And that's why I love editors and makeup artists, because they're the ones who made it real. And they're the ones who did the education around blotting papers and how to use them.
Vicky, what about education do you think really drove Tatcha's growth and continues to do that today?
About education?
Mm-hmm.
We have no choice but to do a lot of education on our collection, because they're so opposite of what you're used to here in the U.S. So using paper to take care of your skin, or cleansing your face with an oil, or polishing your skin as opposed to exfoliating it. Beauty waters or / essences, these are all categories that are still foreign in the U.S. So we have to put a lot of thought into how do we explain this to people in a way that makes sense for them and doesn't scare them off. So I think of us really as an R&D company wrapped in kind of an educational framework wrapped in a giving model. And so, yeah, that's sort of the layers of our company.
What about, you know, we're in this kind of really intense skincare as well as self-care, as mm-hmm. well as wellness movement in beauty. Mm-hmm. What's it like being ahead of that so much? And also, you know, now as more competitors and players come to the space, mm-hmm. how do you continue to clearly state Tatcha's mission and that you were one of the first?
Oh, well, I don't worry too much about who was first. I think if anybody was first, it was really the Japanese women hundreds of years ago. So what I love about the groundswell that has happened from both the consumer side and the brand side around clean, around formulas that have authenticity and heritage is that it's good for everybody. It's good for the client to have more options that are healthy for them. I think it's very healthy for people to think about skincare as self-care versus skincare being a solution to problems. And then by definition, that reduces us as women to a list of problems, which I don't really like. So I think it's a really positive step change in the industry that we're really proud and honored to be able to be a part of.
Next up is John Dempsey, Estee Lauder Company's Executive Group President. In this part, we discuss with John how brands like MAC and Too Faced had progressive customer values and product way before those became a selling point. John, you've been very involved with MAC. You know,
yes.
you were the president there when it was first acquired by Estee Lauder and was very much involved with that development of that story. And, you know, MAC is one of those brands that really kind of always saw influencers, had the right
yes.
message, had the proponents of inclusivity and diversity in its DNA. You know, now that's so much at the forefront, but it's an older brand considerably compared to some of these DTC brands that are coming up. How do you remind people that you were there first?
Well, actually, it's interesting because people always assume that MAC started sort of like when I came on board. I came on board in 1998. The brand actually had existed since 1984. And so it was not an overnight sensation. And the core tenets of artistry and inclusivity and charitable heart were there for a very long time. I like to think that I was lucky to be there with the most amazing brand and to be able to activate the community aspects of what the brand is about. Interestingly enough, I like to say MAC was the original OG. I mean, it really was and continues to be. But a lot of the overnight sensations that people think that have found huge success in a digital consumer direct way have been around a long time too. Actually, Too Faced, which is a brand that we recently acquired, has been around for over 20 years. I mean, Urban Decay did not arrive 5 years ago. A lot of the brands that, you know, today are perceived as new or different actually found their voice or found their mojo in the new ways of communicating. Do we have to continue to tell the story? The answer is absolutely yes. They say, based on research, that if somebody hasn't heard it in the last 36 months, they've never heard it before at all. And that's been a valuable and perhaps sometimes painful lesson for me and others, that we always assume that everybody knows who we are or knows what our products are all about or know what our differentiation is or what makes us unique or what our unique selling proposition is. And in today's digitally savvy, influencer-powered, product-powered world, you have to bid for acceptance and relevancy every single day. And I believe for MAC specifically, the story is true and authentic, and it's not a marketing ploy. And so we today at MAC in a very different competitive world than when I first entered into the brand 21 years ago, authentically are going back to telling our story in authentic ways so that new generations can understand it. But listen, imitation is the greatest form of flattery. And people, you know, I go back to when my mother used to, there used to be a place in New York where we used to buy cosmetics on Madison Avenue. It was called Boyd's Chemist. My father used to get super pissed off, and my mom would go to Boyd's Chemist, and she would come back, and she would buy all this, like, Swiss product. And we say, well, why did you spend, like, you know, $200 on all that product? And she said, well, I bought it. And she said, well, why did you buy it? And she said, because it's from Switzerland. And she said, yeah, and so? And she said, because they told me it was good, because Swiss was better. So, you know, sometimes whoever tells the story first gets the first trial. Whoever actually has the broadest, best product gets the repeat.
So when you think about how you're telling that story today versus how you were telling it maybe 20 years ago on any of these brands, what are the new tactics that you think the Estee Lauder companies are using and using well?
So we focus on many things. First of all, without question, first and foremost is product quality and the quality of our formulations. To me, that is a non-negotiable and something that the Estee Lauder companies prides itself on, that we are the best product formulator, bar none, and we believe that that is table stakes. Secondarily, it's the combination of amazing quality product with authentic storytelling and brand uniqueness and brand characteristics and things that define sort of the value systems and unique DNA of what a brand is about. And people buy products, but people join brands. And the careful balance between joining or welcoming a brand into your home at the same time having a product that you're obsessed with and that you want to continue to buy over and over and over again is a key, is the key to any long-term successful business. But being a brand-building powerhouse and being focused on the unique product development, creativity, and we like to say, people say the last mile, we like to say the last 5 inches or the last 5 feet, that the Estee Lauder companies has always understood that high-touch relationships, whether they be through demonstration, through artistry or consultants or beauty advisors on store, or even today online, or understanding how to communicate in a digital way that sees the customer as a unique individual and makes that experience tailored to that individual. In our mind, the combination of our brand building capabilities, unique product development expertise, research and development, but focus and dedication to high touch and authentic relationships and communities is what defines the company.
Lastly, I spoke with Robert Rosenhack, founder and CEO of CBD brand Lord Jones, which was also just acquired. At one point, I asked Robert about his personal experience with cannabis and how that led him to build his brand. Robert, when you think back to 2013, you know, although you were thinking about both topicals and ingestibles at the time, you started with confectionery, and you thought that that was, you know, a way in. Why did you start there?
It was very personal. So when I was a kid, I suffered from depression, and I grew up in a conservative family, and my dad was a doctor, and they were very anti-drug, and I never used drugs. I never used alcohol. I didn't smoke. I went to college, and I started to gravitate towards people who did use recreational drugs. I thought those people were fun, and I wanted to be around them. They were happy, and they were healthy. And so I started to hang out with them, but I still had this identity as someone who did not use recreational drugs. I didn't drink. I didn't use cannabis. And then toward the end of college, I was with my friends, and they were always teasing me. And one day I was just, you know what? This is silly. I'm curious. I want to try it. And I smoked pot, and I experienced something really profound. So people who suffer from depression and anxiety and they take SSRI, antidepressant medication, they often describe a veil being lifted or all the noise in my head gets lowered or I got in touch with my true self. And I felt that immediately after I smoked this marijuana. And a couple years later, I had a rock climbing accident and I fell and I broke my ankle. I was in crutches for 2 years. It was a pretty severe injury. I had surgeries and I'm all better now. I get around just fine, but I have chronic pain in my ankle. And then later discovered that, wow, if I have this topical that's infused with cannabis and I put it on, it alleviates the pain. So those were the two inspiration points, was that cannabis had the ability to make my mental health improve. It had the ability to make my physical health improve. And that's, again, was really central to our decision to go into the cannabis industry and to create these products.
Tell us a little bit about the skincare piece, because now, you know, everybody has a cannabis skincare line, whether it's hemp oil or CBD. Some people are trying to play with THC. How are you so forward thinking then that, you know, skincare was the next frontier and even this wellness proposition?
That's an interesting question. So back again, if you, in 2013, 2014, there was some data available in the medical marijuana dispensaries. And if you looked at it, most people were buying cannabis flower. People started to buy cannabis concentrates and vape pens, and edibles was a growing category. And if you looked at skincare, it was less than 1% of the sales in the medical marijuana dispensaries.
When was this?
2013, 2014. And so, you know, well, why would you want to go into the category that's less than 1% of sales? We just knew it worked. And again, at the time, the whole medical marijuana industry, as so far as it was an industry, was really geared towards a lot of the stoner stereotypes, high potency edibles. And we just knew that there were consumers like you, like me, like our friends who were, you know, interested in culture, interested in aspirational brands, interested in health and wellness, and that this was going to become legal. It was going to become a movement. It was going to go mainstream. And we knew that skincare was going to be a big category because we knew personally that these things worked. We use these products. And we knew that there were many more people like us who were not in the medical marijuana system that would eventually come in. And that's where we are today.
You mentioned the word cannacurious a second ago. And, you know, nowadays, Lord Jowens is the only CBD brand in Sephora. You're in Soul Cycles all over the country. Who is your customer? Who is this man or woman that's coming to you?
I think it's anybody who's looking for solutions using CBD. So it's not just one demographic. I think it's a psychographic, and it is people who are curious. So cannabis and CBD are everywhere now. They're everywhere because of basically two milestones. One is all the work that's been done in the medical marijuana movement, the legalization movement of cannabis. Most Americans live in a state where some form of cannabis is legal, some form of THC. And the second is now we live in a country where CBD is legal. So in December of 2018, we passed a new farm bill. It was signed into law that legalized hemp and all of the derivatives of hemp federally. So now these products are more available. There are brands like ours and others that have gotten notoriety. And so people are super curious. And people are curious what these products do. There's a whole popular notion that cannabis is safe. It's safer than alcohol. There are people who want alternatives to chemical pharmaceuticals, and people are super curious about cannabis.
So even though the Farm Bill passed in December, there's no regulation about how much CBD is in, you know, a skincare product versus an edible or versus, you know, a serum. So tell us a little bit about how you approach that when there are so many other supposed snake oil brands on the market.
Yeah, you're identifying a number of issues and a number of problems and challenges. So the consumer is so far out in front of the regulators and the lawmakers, and the Farm Bill made hemp legal, but it also looks forward to the federal government and state governments regulating it. And right now there isn't a lot of regulation. And there isn't a lot of education. So people are hungry for education. And it's really falling on brands to educate people as to what the products are, what the dosages are, how do you use these products. So we definitely need more regulation. We need more education so that customers, consumers have this information available to them.
Thanks again for joining us for our special anniversary episode of the Glossy Beauty Podcast. We look forward to many more birthdays with you, and we'll be back tomorrow with our weekly episode.